John Gormley. What a fabulous looking day. And if this is the beginning of your week of summer vacation, maybe a couple of weeks, or you're right in the middle of it, a terrific week to be out and about. And I hope you're getting to beaches, out with a little bit of nature. And I'm glad that you have inserted into your busy holiday schedule a little time for this radio program. I was chatting recently with you about Joel Kotkin's piece in the National Post called Electric Vehicle Mandates Are an Assault on the Middle Class. And it caused a few of you to ask, well, who's Joel Kotkin? Author of a dozen books, nearly. The latest one, The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class. Professor at Chapman University in Orange, California. And as you know, I spend a lot of time in Orange County, in Yorba Linda, and that's where we find Joel Kotkin in Orange County this morning to talk a little about the new book and what the assault on the middle class means when it comes to EVs and government policy. Joel, welcome to Saskatchewan. So good to have you here.
Hi, it's my pleasure.
Tell me a little about what's happening. And Canada, of course, is like a lot of European nations. We have a 20% mandatory minimum EV sale by the end of 25. We have a 60% minimum 2030, 100% by 2035. What are these policies doing to the average family?
Well, it's right now, of course, the effects are still, you know, somewhat marginal. It's more in the future. But the reality is the average, the most recent numbers I've seen is the average family that buys an EV has an income of about $150,000. EVs are just expensive. Now, maybe they'll come down in price, but I'm not so sure that that's going to happen given the fact that when you essentially mandate one technology over all other technologies, including, by the way, hybrids, which are very clean and actually have less waste in many ways than the current crop of EVs, we really are driving ourselves, if you will, into a situation where essentially the automobile, which has been, along with the single-family house, kind of the marker of democracy, upward mobility, autonomy, and basically going back to what we had, you know, 100 years ago, where the people who owned homes in many, particularly in urban areas, tended to be the wealthy, and cars were something that rich people had. And if you look at what's happening and the sort of logic behind net zero and the EVs, I don't think the idea is that everybody's going to have their own EV. I think if you read the environmental literature, they want cars to be limited, even if they are EVs. So what you're basically going to do is you're going to create an artificial market of a fairly expensive product that requires, of course, all sorts of enhancements to the grid. That, you know, would work fine for wealthy people. I mean, I live in a fairly affluent part of Orange County, and I see a lot of Teslas, the same people who used to drive BMWs.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's who's driving Teslas. You go into working class, even middle class neighborhoods, particularly outside of California, and you'll see very few Teslas. So essentially what we're doing is we're creating just what has to be an enormous distortion. There's also going to be a lot of pain on the industrial side. Since autos are a big industry, they tend to pay well. They tend to be unionized. And, of course, Canada, particularly Ontario, has always had a strong automobile industry. That's going to have a reduction in employment somewhere around 30%, according to what I've been seeing. And finally, in essentially handing things over to EVs, we're basically replacing ourselves as the center of the auto industry with China. China does not control the auto industry now. If we go on this path, within 10 years, China will be the center of the auto industry.
Joel Kotkin in Orange County, California. He's a professor at Chapman University Urban Reform Institute, the Urban Futures Fellow at University of Chapman in Orange, California. So speak, if you would, elaborate on the China issue, because you point out that China has actually been playing both sides on this issue, embracing EVs, but controlling a lot of the minerals and the technology for battery development.
Right, and to add to the irony, driving a lot of it with coal-powered electricity.
Right.
I mean, so basically, the Chinese are, we're basically being, you know, played, you know, I don't know if the audience is old enough to remember Muhammad Ali, but he used to say, you know, rope-a-dope. Well, yep. They're playing rope-a-dope with us. Rope-a-dope in the boxing ring was you let the opponent, you know, wear himself out trying to connect with you, and then when he's tired, you attack. Well, that's kind of what the Chinese are doing to us. They're saying, oh, yeah, we love the EV technology since, you know, we're not an oil-producing country anyway. So what we'll do is we'll take over this particular market. It happens to be that China itself has some of the raw materials. They also tend to control the materials in Africa, Indonesia, and other countries that are critical. And so essentially what they're doing is they're taking a free ride. They're saying, we're going to go dominate the EV industry. We're going to use coal-powered power to get there in large part. And you're going to end up with a very weak industry. Maybe you'll get to assemble things that are essentially made in China. And then when we're ready to make the move to net zero, which they figure around 2050, 2060, they'll develop nuclear power. They're not going to go the wind and solar route, which is just, I don't think, ever going to give you the power that, and on a reliable basis, that you need in an advanced industrial society. And we're just, you know, frankly, we're being played. It's not, you don't have to be a CIA analyst to see this. Of course, CIA analysts will probably be the last person to realize it. I mean, the reality is that we are essentially ceding things to a country that is, you know, in many ways opposed to our values and opposed to pretty much what we want to see in the world. And we're letting them do it to us and being made to feel virtuous about it.
Professor Joel Kotkin with us, urban planner, Urban Reform Institute director at Chapman University in Orange County, author of a dozen books, and his latest book pursues what he calls the coming of neo-feudalism. And of course, as he points out, think back, you know, before the end of the Second World War, when the middle class flourished, when families could buy a car, buy a home. Go back 100 years and then start going back further than that. Last word to you, Joel, on power generation. You know, we look at even existing, and you alluded to it, wind and solar are not going to be baseload. So let's move ahead into an EV world where everybody wants to plug their car in after supper at night.
Well, and of course, you know what that's going to be. It's going to be a huge increase in electricity demand. And of course, at the same time, states like California, and I think the U.S. in general, is moving towards electrifying virtually everything. So you're going to have more demand, but where's the power going to come from? I mean, basically, you're going to need to do nuclear power, probably some natural gas to get there. And the Greens, who are pushing for the EVs, are the same people who oppose both of those. So it's what we might call a bit of a conundrum.
Does the public engage enough yet in this discussion? I mean, every Canadian survey, and of course our winters are way harsher, especially out here on the prairies, you know, people at an intellectual level sort of look at the EV and say, that's interesting, but here they're just not reliable enough on charge and they're too expensive.
Right, and what's tragic in my mind is that we have had, with the development of the hybrid engine by Toyota in particular, we have a technology that deals with the vast majority of the emissions issue. gets tremendous mileage. The batteries have far less toxic chemicals and minerals than the Tesla batteries. I'm not against electric cars. I just think they should be able to compete against other low emissions technologies. And that is usually the way that you get to the best point. You don't say, hey, we're going to do technology A and B, but we're not even going to consider C, D, and E, even though those in the marketplace may do much better. You take a look at the hybrid engine, which I'm a big fan of. The hybrid engine means that you get many of the advantages of electrical transmission, but at the same time, you can still put gas in your car. You don't have to completely change absolutely everything, and put charging stations in all sorts of places. And then, of course, we have other issues. And particularly, you mentioned the winters in California. My wife is Canadian and from Montreal. But the real problem is that it also doesn't operate very well in cold weather.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, cold weather and very hot weather doesn't work very well with the EV. So, again, technology develops best on a crowded stage where there's lots of people playing, and then you get to the best products. I mean, I covered Silicon Valley in the 1980s, and that was an enormously competitive environment. And out of that came a lot of the innovation that defines our society today. If we had decided that we were only going to allow one type of technology, if we tried to control the internet the way the French tried to do it with the ordinateur, we wouldn't be remotely where we are in terms of the technology. We have to acknowledge that there also may be lots of new things that will come up, you know, in terms of electricity generation and in terms of mobility that we haven't even developed yet, that we don't even know about. And to stick ourselves on a one technology which has lots of issues and put all our bets on that technology, I think is foolhardy.
Joel, great meeting you today. Thanks so much for doing what you do and continued success.
Great. Thank you very much.
Joel Kotkin in Orange County, California, Professor Chapman University, and penned a great piece recently in the National Post, Electric Vehicle Mandates Are an Assault on the Middle Class. And that is in part an excerpt from his new book, The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, because he's written a lot on class in modern, particularly America. He is an urbanist, but his one book, and I laughed at this one because I thought of you when I saw it, Urbanism for the Rest of Us. It was called The Human City. And because, of course, urbanists, I mean, Charlie Bike Lanes Clark's an urbanist. The city transportation manager was in the studio with me. He's an urbanist. They're all about walking and riding bikes. They do not want cars in their cities. That's the conventional urbanist. Well, Joel Kotkin wrote Urbanism for the Rest of Us. And, livable, accessible, terrific people-oriented cities, but not these ones that just have this assault on, in the name of green, all things four-wheeled. But what do you think when you hear this kind of talk? I was looking at some background on this, and I laughed. This goes back a few months now. Probably the top marketing slogan in some time, the Dodge Ram Revolution. Because, there's the Ford F-150 Lightning. Well, Dodge Ram has a thing called the Revolution, and it's their electric truck. Here's marketing 101. They're working on a thing called the Range Extended Paradigm Breaker. So they're going to have a Range Extended Paradigm Breaker on the Dodge Revolution 150 or 1500. You know what it is? A gas-powered engine. Because even the manufacturers of the Dodge Ram, just like the Lightning, know it sucks for hauling. It sucks in cold weather. You can't get it charged. So the Range Extended Paradigm Breaker is going to be a little tiny gas power assist. in the name of an EV. 877-332-8255. This is 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. Joel Conkin was just here, the guy who writes that the mandates for electric vehicles, thou shalt own an electric vehicle, notwithstanding the prime minister saying, he was going on the other day, this will create jobs and a cleaner future for everyone. Not so fast, Sparky. We're going to be doing, pardon the pun, Sparky, battery manufacturing here at considerable subsidy. But the actual assembly of purely electric vehicles, the number one manufacturer in the world, Joel Kotkin was pointing out, is not Tesla. The number one manufacturer in the world today of EVs is a Chinese company called BYD. And it's the largest manufacturer and produces twice as many EVs as all of Europe and the U.S. combined. So China's not only cornering the market on the battery technology, you'll be assembling Chinese products here, which will be the way it'll work. Joel Kotkin and the rest of us who have looked into it like hybrids. I think hybrids are really cool. Driven lots of them. Not owned one yet, but that's a matter of time. Dennis in Saskatoon, though, has turned to hybrids. What's that experience been like? You there, Dennis?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, my phone cut out there whenever you were saying my name.
No worries.
We were looking for a plug-in hybrid for a while, and they're pretty tough to find, but we ended up walking into a dealership looking actually for a kind of a used electric car. My wife is drives around the city for work, so, and she just got that job recently, so we thought, you know, something putzing around so we don't have to wait in line for gas every second day type thing, and found a plug-in hybrid. So we get roughly, it says up to 55 kilometers per electric charge, but I mean, that's in perfect conditions, and we've had it for, I'd say, 3-4 months, so I mean, beautiful weather so far, so we get about that, which is about her shift, so basically burn no gas, charges on a 110 volt, so we don't need any special adapters for the house, charges overnight in 8 hours, and yeah, so far it's awesome.
Okay, so it's got Can't power complain. Assist. It's a hybrid with power assist or full electric?
No, it's a plug-in hybrid. So okay. It's got a 27-liter gas tank as well, right? So once you run out of the electric charge, it just kicks into a normal hybrid.
Now, so when it's running on gas, does it also charge, or do you need the plug-in to supplement that?
Yeah, no, it charges as well. So, like, I think we had it for about a week, and then we actually took it out to Kelowna and Banff. And on average, because of the hybrid portion, like, we didn't worry about charging it on the way there or anything like that. It just filled up at normal gas stations. And I think we averaged, like, around 4 liters per...
Whoops. Okay, good stuff. 4 liters per 100 kilometers. Good stuff. Hang on, a lot more calls ahead on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. I'm John Gormley. Good to have you here. Hope this Tuesday is rolling out just the way you want. Let's get back to the calls. We were chatting with Joel Kotkin, professor at Chapman University in Orange County, California. He is an urbanist, and one of his dozen books at the Urban Reform Institute was Urbanism for the Rest of Us. He's not the, you know, Charlie Biklanes Clark, you know, the whole anti-cars, everybody should walk and ride a bike urbanist, which appears to be, you know, the Jane Jacobs school. And there are other ways to think urbanism. And of course, what you want are accessible, usable, beautiful cities. And he argues that government mandated electric vehicles, where, and Europe is doing the same thing, Canada's doing, even the states. The states are not mandating as much as they are throwing so much money at it in the Biden agenda that it's distorting markets and everybody is being forced now to move electric. There are some U.S. policies, but Canada's laid out exactly the percentage of vehicles that shall be electric. And his point was, you want a stage that's crowded. You want a place that says move toward less emitting vehicles, but if you want to go hydrogen, you want to go hybrid, you want to go some other kind of vehicle, that's where you get better competitive outcomes. Ron in Lestock, thank you for hanging on, sir. What do you see in terms of the road ahead, pardon the pun, for cars?
Well, two different things about this guy talking. That one, I find it insane we're making all these electric cars. When the Saskatchewan Research Council years ago hooked a computer to the car's computer, which they said was a nightmare, took the extra energy the alternator puts out, put it through water, we're driving around, they put hydrogen right into the motor and we're driving around on water. Like, we could do that here 6 months of the year, year-round around the equator. So we wouldn't have to build all these new cars with all these giant batteries. Cheap electricity, technology's there. Iceland used geothermic from the volcano to create electricity, heat the homes. They even use it for cooking with. Well, Yellowstone has an endless amount of fuel there for free once the infrastructure's set up. Like, why is nobody doing that?
Yeah, good questions all. The geothermal here has also, Meg, you know that the one project Sask Power is working on is taking off now. I mean, it's being commercialized. But yeah, these are all things to keep in mind. But when you go electric to the exclusion of everything, you also, and Joel Kotkin made the point, then start saying you have to double electric generation. And wind and solar ain't going to do that. In fact, wind and solar aren't going to carry your grid today. So you'll move to nuclear. And he points out that, of course, in the radical environmental movement, and that's where, Canada's minister, the Green Jesus of Montreal, Stephen Guibeau. I mean, Guibeau comes from a strong, harshly strong anti-nuke world. Other anti-nukes like Jonathan Wilkinson have since recanted, and Wilkinson now has become a great proponent of nuclear, which is good. But the conventional left-wing environmentalist is really anti-nuke. So the only answer to doubling your capacity, if you can't get hydro, for example, and you can't around here, will be to move to nuclear, and we'll do that. Other survey that was done, and this story was out just the end of June, J.D. Power, the car rating company, they do a survey every few years on essentially consumer alignment with electric. And one of the things that was interesting, in the States, consumer interest and alignment with electric is starting to move upward. In Canada, it's going the opposite way. The last J.D. Power study, and this is just out end of June, 66% of Canadians are unlikely, either very or somewhat, to consider an electric vehicle. That's a full two-thirds. And at 66%, that's up 13% in the last few years. So if anything, as bombarded as we've been by government regulation, bombarded as we've been by all things electric, there's a 13% jump in a lack of interest in buying EVs. So I don't know what's going to come of this, but of course, the EV community, which is very small, particularly in this province and places, you know, I think we're at 1,000 now, 1,100. For years, we were at under 200, then 400. And as we begin to increase, there will be more electric vehicles. And particularly urban-only electric vehicles, assuming you're going to have a reliable electricity source, they'll have a lifetime and they'll have an applicability, I think. not broadly, even in the city, when it hits minus 45, you've got some questions of reliability on your charge. And, of course, the entry-level cost. Joel Kotkin said most family incomes of people in the uptake of electric vehicles, $150,000 plus. And that's same way it is here. Okay, so a lot more speculation going on, just to give you the quick update this morning on this Trudeau cabinet shuffle. You remember there were to be three announcements yesterday morning, just in the normal course of things, federal cabinet ministers making announcements. Three were waved off. The Minister of Transport, Omer Al-Gabra, was supposed to make some ministerial announcement yesterday. They postponed it. Well, this morning, he confirmed he's not running again as a Liberal. So that's a sign a cabinet shuffle's coming. The Diversity and Inclusion and Housing Minister, Ahmed Hussein, had his news conference waved off yesterday. We don't know why. And the minister responsible for official languages, Jeanette Petipa-Taylor, who's a New Brunswicker, she had her news conference waved off yesterday. We don't know why. But along with Omer Al-Gabra this morning, Fisheries and Oceans Minister Joyce Murray has announced she's not running again, and the Public Services Minister Halina Jazic also announced she's not running. And yesterday, of course, there was the announcement by Carolyn Bennett that she would not be running anymore. She's the Addictions Minister. So that's four present members of the cabinet have thus far announced they will not be seeking re-election. Now, for those of you, and I had an interesting chat this morning with a buddy who said, well, you know, cabinet shuffles come when everything's messed up and everything's devolving. Sometimes. But any government, after usually a couple of years, and it's been a couple of years, is going to reshuffle the deck, if you think of it that way. You've got a cabinet. Certain ministers have proved themselves very adept, very able at communicating the message, navigating through the capital P politics and the small P politics of running a government department, and it's time for them to take on something else. Other ministers haven't fared so well, Marco Mendicino. So certain ministers struggle, and you think, gosh, there are better performers around than that person. So it's just like thinking of your management team at work. Every so often, the boss wants to be able to say, hey, I want to move somebody who's got some potential up and in. I want to move somebody else perhaps back a bit to something more in keeping with their skills and their abilities. So it's not so much a sense of crisis, but the speculation begins once you've got a new cabinet to say, aha, this is the cabinet the prime minister is going to take into an election. I have trouble explaining, but I am convinced still we could be into an election this fall. So for people like me, I'll use that as evidence that I think there's an election coming. You know, there'll be a new cabinet sworn in tomorrow. Others will say equally properly, well, the one thing with a new cabinet now is he's got a couple of years of clear sailing to let that cabinet carry out its work. So you get an idea here. Nobody's got the right answer. This is 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. John Wormley, top of the hour, a lot of talk lately, particularly that Toronto Star series on the plans afoot by the new Commissioner Duhaime of the RCMP, aided and abetted by the Prime Minister, by Marco Mendicino, and others in the political classes, to turn the RCMP into, quote, Canada's FBI. Well, they already are Canada's FBI. They do federal crimes. They do issues on cybersecurity, money laundering, international terrorism, all else. But the issue, of course, is the RCMP contract policing. Every single Mountie serving today and for decades has been trained by going through the RCMP's Depot Division in Regina. We're going to chat with Chief Superintendent Sylvie Bourassa-Muse, who is the commander of Depot Division, And they've got something on for lay people like you and I to have a behind-the-scenes look at what goes on at Depo. Pretty cool thing they're rolling out. You'll learn more about that top of the hour. Speaking of the RCMP, they reported, and this is interesting, a dramatic increase on the crime stats in extortion cases. Now, all of this will start to connect the dots in your mind. Do you remember months ago, the RCMP had given the word that so-called sextortion was on the rise? This appears to be the basis of a 200% increase in extortion offenses. So January to June of this year, just 6 months, 105 reports of extortion compared to 36 reports over that same six-month period last year. So Monica Dieters, who's a crime analyst with the RCMP, says a 200% increase is alarming, and because of the sensitive nature of these extortions, we believe the files are likely underreported to the police. And the sensitive nature, of course, is sextortion. How does that work? The most victimized people, you will remember the conversation we had a few months ago, tend to be teenage boys, but people young and old get wrapped up in this. So typically, the victim meets somebody online, a social media platform, some kind of common shared gaming sites, dating sites, whatever. Communication then moves into perhaps more intimate texting, chat sites, direct messaging. So they're having a relationship, you put in quotes. So the suspect then persuades the victim to send a nude photo, video, something fairly physically revealing. Then turns it around and says, I'm going to send it to your parents, your entire contact list, post it publicly, do whatever, unless you pay me X, Y, or Z. So it's that simple. I mean, it's not clearly for the victim a simple thing. It's horrible. But the kind of extortion is relatively easy for the criminals. And there's a victim pool that can be taken advantage of. Even, and this is an example of a young victim pool, even when there isn't something shared, the extortionist will often say, well, I have photos now of your face. You know, you've sent me all these pictures of you. I'm going to Photoshop those pictures in to certain video or certain pictures that I have. So it's going to look like you were doing all these things. Pay me money and I won't do it. So it's, and of course, for a young, vulnerable victim, that kind of intimidation can frighten people. Another scam is where the perp tells a victim they've hacked their computer or their phone or they're monitoring their online activities. And then it starts with, unless you pay me X, Y, and Z, I'm going to send details of your conversations to your parents, to your friends, to somebody else. And even if there isn't anything compromising that the young person's done, the extortionist convinces them that they've obtained some pretty sensitive material. So, and again, and you can see how this really works on, sadly, on young people. Police tips. You never, ever know who you're talking to online. Be aware. Scammers are there and they're going to act and behave like someone you trust. And they're going to try to cultivate your trust. Don't send intimate photos or videos. The minute you do that, you've lost control. And for the parents in the lives, keep an eye on your kids' online activity, social media use, history, and talk to them about online safety. And for the victims, stop talking to the subject, deactivate social media accounts, but don't delete them. Keep any kinds of records you can find for conversations with a suspect. Don't send them anything by way of payment. And of course, call the police. So the, again, when you see extortion by an increase of 200%, clearly it's online sextortion cases, and we've been talking about that for a little while. Other story today, the company Cirium, which samples airline travel, finding out a contrast between Canadian and U.S. aviation data, highest proportion of canceled flights, delayed flights, are two big Canadian airlines, Air Canada and WestJet. On-time percentages range from the high 60s to the low 80s for the big five airlines in the U.S. Air Canada's running 50%. WestJet's running 36% on-time arrivals. So our two Canadian airlines still well below what people now expect and bank on U.S. airtimes being. I'm John Gormley. This is 980 CJME and 650 CKOM.